This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida. Wow, wow, this is an exciting day. I have two brilliant authors on today. At the bottom of the hour, I have Veena Rao, and her book is called Purple Lotus. It is an amazing, amazing first book, and I'm looking forward to talking to her. But right now, I am turning to an absolute genius. I'm just so thrilled with this book and with this author. I can't believe it. Oh, and I should say, dear. he's very dear. Brian Deer. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Patsy with a Z.
Oh, well, that's good you didn't say Z. When I moved to England, and I did, when I was 21 years old, I moved to England from Michigan. And, of course, I had always told people Patsy with a Z. And I get to England, Z, what's a Z? No. So, it's good. And you have a British accent, which I'm so happy. Well, as I said, I lived in England for a long time, so I got accustomed to it, and I love it.
Well, all I can say is you're easily pleased, Patsy.
Well, you know, I am. But I've always for a British accent, and of course, I must tell you, right off the bat, and everybody, you have the best narrator in the world doing your book. Dennis Clyman is unbelievable.
I think so. I think we chose well with Dennis.
You can listen to him.
He doesn't sound like me though, does he?
Oh,
he's
very, very dramatic. As a matter of fact, I think if he'd like, I will have him on the program, and he can read parts of the book for me because I love having narrators on. I had for a Gentleman in Moscow. I had his narrator come on, and Nicholas Guy Smith, and I talk to authors all the time, right? And what person do I get the most mail for? Nicholas Guy Smith, because they love that recording of A Gentleman in Moscow. So I will definitely have him on, but I will settle for your voice. It's pretty good to me, and I tell you. Well, you know, you have to be an American to get a Pulitzer Prize, right?
You do, unfortunately. Well, not that I've looked. Not that I have ambitions.
Since you can't get a, because you're not American, you get. No. I think they should give you the Nobel Prize. That's what I think. Because you have.
Well, that's very kind of
you. You have, of course, been nominated three times for the British Press Award. Did you finally win it?
Twice, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, because, I mean, you are something special. Anybody who can write a nonfiction book and make it so good that I had to kept check a couple of times that it was a nonfiction book. I said, is this nonfiction? Yes, and then when you write this, and did I tell people the name of the book? The Doctor Who Fooled the World, Science, Deception, and the War on Vaccines. Now, it's a title that does not do it justice because it is so fascinating. This book is so good. And as I said, it's nonfiction, but you write, your writing is incredible. Few nonfiction writers can write like you. And in one part, I just have to read one part. We're going to talk about this guy. We'll talk about Wakefield. I want you to explain who he is. But I love this part where you say, 2 years before his arrival, I can't even read it. It's so good. Wakefield married Carmel. That's Carmel Philomena O'Donovan, a diet-conscious, blonde-haired Zelda to his Scott. where do I get this? I mean, I got such a kick out of this writing. You are amazing.
Well, I have to say, that particular quote, the copy editor who edited the book, she wanted to put in Fitzgerald. And I said, well, no, if they don't know who Scott and Zelda are, then it's best just to move on quickly and let them read the rest of the book. But we had this big discussion about, because obviously it's Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. And,
of course.
And she wanted to put that in.
Oh, no. That would ruin it. That's the beauty of it. It's the beauty of it. You're reading along and you're reading a serious... serious story about somebody.
Yeah, I think a lot of good writing is about withholding information and not giving it information.
I mean, anybody who didn't know who Scott and Zelda were, I hope they looked it up because actually, it's funny. You know, I'm here in Clearwater, Florida, in St. Petersburg, Clearwater area, and Scott and Zelda were here for the opening of our most beautiful hotel, and that was back in 1926. And they actually, Zelda... danced naked on the beach here. I got such a kick out of that. And when I, exactly, you know, and I noticed that you didn't put Fitzgerald. I thought, well, he has integrity and he has respect for his reader, assuming that we are a little bit literate. Maybe
I think people like that, don't they? People like to think that you're sharing a secret with them, something you have in common. You don't have to, like, spell everything out all the time.
Exactly. I thought it was genius. Yeah. That's why I would give you the Nobel Prize for Literature just for that one. Because, I mean, really, these people really, because some of the books they pick, I hate to say it. Anyway, we have to talk about this book, but I could talk to you for hours about so many things, because one of the exciting things is I have to say hello to my son at the University of Wisconsin, who, of course, you know that area. It's wonderful. And he's stuck up there. He can't come down here for a while. But he's a biomedical engineer, and he works at a cellular level. So it's a subject that's interesting to him, of course, and to me. So let's introduce this book. What is it about, and who is this guy? Because this is an amazing story of Andrew Wakefield.
Let me put it the way. The Doctor Who Fooled the World really tells the story of what many medical scientists now regard to have been the most, damaging scientific fraud in 100 years. What he did, this man named Andrew Wakefield, what he did essentially was to fake research on children's vaccines. He claimed to have discovered a new syndrome of disease which linked the MMR children's vaccine, the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, with autism. And he published something, a paper in The Lancet, a long time ago now, way back in 1998, he published a paper in The Lancet Medical Journal, which is a very prestigious journal, where he claimed to have found this link between the MMR vaccine and autism. And it set off a huge scare in the UK and really was the acorn from which the modern anti-vaccine movement has grown, this particular paper that he wrote. And everybody believed it because, at face value, what he was suggesting, that he might have discovered the first snapshot, if you like, of a hidden epidemic of injuries being caused to children all over the world. Because he was reporting on 12 kids who he said showed evidence of injury from the MMR vaccine. So it set off a huge scare. There was a slump in immunization rates. There were outbreaks of disease. And then he moved to the United States, exporting this alarm from the UK to the United States. And then I came along later, at the beginning of an investigation that has run on now for, I think it's about 15 years on and off. I mean, not working on it the whole time, that has pieced together an investigation which I carried out for the Sunday Times of London, and it revealed the true story behind that paper and what he did, the real people involved, and the specific facts of how this paper led to the emergence of this anti-vaccine movement, and what people now, scientists now, recognize to be the most outrageous fraud that Wakefield managed to engineer behind the face of this paper.
Oh, this story is so fascinating, and you are a detective, like the old school. I mean, you do work and research and go into things that just at an amazing level. I was Do you want to read the paragraph? I sent a word about if you could read that paragraph about back in the day. Do you want or?
I haven't got a copy of the book.
Me, I shall read it then. I have to read it.
Oh, maybe I have got a copy.
I can't do it.
I have got a copy.
Do you want?
I have got a copy now.
Right in the beginning, where you say, back in the day, he'd been a nobody.
Oh yes, I know. Hang on.
Brilliant writing? Everything in this book is brilliant writing. But I love that. Yeah. I love that. Because it's just sets out the whole story right there. And after you read that, you just want to keep going and digging in and finding out who in the heck this guy was because he's still around, unfortunately. So we have to, if you don't have that passage, I have it. It's right there.
Just tell me what page is it on.
It's on right in the beginning, in the prologue. In the day.
Yeah, I'm just. Which
pages? They don't have a page number on it. Why don't? Do I have an early book or something? I don't know why. I have no page number.
Got it.
With drama.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. He'd originally acquired profile on my side of the Atlantic, in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Back in the day, he'd been nobody, a doctor without patients at a third-rate London hospital and medical school. He'd been a laboratory gastroenterologist, a former trainee gut surgeon, most relevantly defined by what he wasn't. He wasn't a virologist, immunologist, or epidemiologist. He wasn't a neurologist, psychologist, or psychiatrist. He wasn't a pediatrician or a clinician.
Oh, boy, but he is a con man.
As time passed, however, he became a global player, a man with his fingerprints on nations. But he didn't offer healing or scientific insight. He brought epidemics of fear, guilt, and disease. And that was the man. That is the man. He was responsible for this piece of research, and I was able to expose the fact that his research, the whole thing was rigged. He changed diagnoses that other doctors made of patients. He altered the interpretations of pathology results. The children themselves who'd come to the hospital for these tests had actually been sent to him by an anti-vaccine group. And 2 years before he published this paper, he'd been hired by a firm of lawyers to make exactly this case, to be an attack dog against the MMR vaccine. And nobody knew any of this. All this came out. He presented himself as being an independent academic researcher with new information for the safety of children. And the whole thing was a scam.
And with a heck of a background. I mean, we are talking a major background. And the way you write it, the way you introduce his story and him is so good. Tell us about it. We wouldn't expect it from, we wouldn't expect it from anybody, but particularly with his background. Why?
Well, firstly, he did it for money because the lawyer offered him an enormous amount of money to do this work. And ultimately, Wakefield made in today's US dollars probably about $800,000 for the work that he did, because this particular piece of research was designed to get a class action lawsuit going, which is what it succeeded in doing. So he was being paid at hourly rates as a result of his deception. But then on top of that, he was also a man of ideas. His father was a neurologist before the days of scanning, and he was one of these, a very grand person in medicine. I think his son wanted to live up to that, and he had big ideas, and he came up with this idea. Scientists, I think, younger scientists tend to want to come up with a bright idea, and the idea he came up with wasn't that bright, but it was that that measles virus was the cause, firstly, of bowel disease, and then he moved on to autism after he started working for this lawyer. And he couldn't let go of this idea. He thought that he discovered the ultimate sort of culprit for all kinds of disorders in measles virus. And he got this idea, bizarrely enough, reading an encyclopedia in the hospital library. So it wasn't like, this was any great discovery on his part. But no, it was really about himself, a desire for fame, a desire for glory, a desire to live up to the his father's expectations. But in the end, I found he was a man who this is kind of a challenge for a writer, really, because he's a man who doesn't change. He wasn't somebody as a result of my journalism, he lost his license to practice medicine, his paper was retracted, and he was professionally ruined. But he learnt nothing from it. He said sorry for nothing. He didn't change. And I think in dramatic terms, when you're telling a story, it's always quite difficult to write about characters who don't change, because that gives you part of the drive of a very satisfying story. Because I think it's important, if you're writing nonfiction, well, it was important for me, not to be like holding forth, telling people about vaccinations or whether you should vaccinate your children or whether they cause autism or this, that, and the other, but just to tell the story of the real people and lay out the specific facts and take the reader on a journey. And your response to the book actually really confirms me with me that I took the right decision there, because I was under, you know, quite a lot of pressure, particularly because the book is published by Johns Hopkins University, which is a huge academic press. And they have kind of academic standards, which I had to adhere to. And at the same time, write in a language and with a style that ordinary people would find to be an interesting story. So we had all these fights. I had all these fights with editors because I used a word like shit fight. I said this person was in a potential lawsuit, and it would require lots of money for this shit fight with the pharmaceutical industry. And people go, "Oh, can you really say shit fight?" Oh, well, whatever the American accent equivalent of that British way of saying it would be. So it was very hard to reconcile being published by an academic publisher in their general trade list. So it's for ordinary readers. But at the same time, being academically rigorous, then I had another challenge, which is I had to provide all the evidence. So underlying the manuscript, there's more than 2,000 documents, which I supplied to the publisher so they could check that the story was true. Because this man, Wakefield, he denies it all. He says he never committed fraud. He never said vaccines cause autism, that I'm working for the pharmaceutical industry, that I'm part of a conspiracy with government, Rupert Murdoch, and you know, whoever else. So he denies it all. So it had to be true, it had to be evidenced, and it had to be written in a way that would get people from the start to the end. And so that was quite a challenge. It took me a long time.
You've done such a great job here. And if it gets the right press, because unfortunately, now everybody's interested in vaccination. So perhaps it will, you know, really now start to resonate, because it's so well written. Just the story, when, for example, at the beginning where you're talking about his ancestral home and his family, and you lay the groundwork so that we start to see the type of person he was. And of course, the reason I was thinking Nobel Prize for you is that he wanted one in medicine. And, you know, he could imagine this. And so, but there's so much money and ambition behind, of course, what he did, wanting money, wanting fame without having the talent to come out with something original. And so it's an important book, and people are now going to be looking at, you know, the whole vaccine thing is happening. I don't have really, you know, I really should have planned it better and had you on for the entire hour, because it's when the vaccine comes out, like in another month, will you come back on so we can talk?
Yeah,
more?
Yeah, sure,
about,
absolutely.
Because I think that there are so many details, and one of the things, I mean, I think the financial aspects of an involvement of drug companies and researchers in wanting money and getting money, or for example, you talked in there about some people who have share, you know, some doctors or you know, people who have shares in companies, so they have a stake in whether something works out. And I think that's one of the fears of, you know, that it should be They should be making these vaccines to save us, you know.
Yeah, well, one of the things I say in the book is if he could do what he did, who else is doing what in the laboratories and the hospitals that we're now looking to for our lives in this coronavirus thing? So, I absolutely agree with you that the public's trust in the safety of vaccines is a massively topical concern. Anyone who thinks that I should get the Nobel Prize is certainly someone I've got plenty of time for, and I'm very happy to come back.
Okay, well, we'll arrange it because I can't get into all of it right now. It's just too complex. Yeah. But I am a great believer that there should be transparency. If a doctor, a researcher has an investment in a company that, you know, it would financially, you know, benefit them, and that goes for people who work in all of the government, you know, different FDA, CDC, all of these. I think there should be transparency. We should know if people own shares in a company.
I agree.
Because I don't know. There's going to be four companies now. We don't know who owns shares in what. And I think everybody really should know that before they start pushing things. But I think you'll be a better advocate for learning, because you certainly have a way of digging in. I'm sure that you're going to be doing more. This subject is going to be out there for a long time. So I will get to your people, and then we can talk about how much I loved living in England. I bought a cottage in Sonning. Do you know where Sonning is?
Oh, wow. Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay. So a 400-year-old cottage. We can talk about that. We can talk about you've been a lecturer at my son's school and also at the University of Michigan, right?
Yep.
And if necessary, we have to make you an honorary American so they can give you the Pulitzer Prize for this great book. And it's called The Doctor Who Fooled the World, Science, Deception, and the War on Vaccine. And the author's name is Brian Deere. I mean, that is such a beautiful name. You must have had fun in school. Everybody, oh dear, yeah. Oh dear.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
You heard that one, yes, I'm sure. And then when they call you out, you know, when you were in grade school, they call, oh, dear Brian. You had fun with that name. It's a great name. It's easy to remember. Everybody, this book is available wherever books are sold. Do you have a website, Twitter, Facebook? Where do you like people?
You can find me, Brian Deere. You can find my website easily enough, and you can find me on Amazon as well, where they sell, I think, books.
Oh, yes, that's important. Amazon, right there. Head straight for... And, you know, the book is just a fun... I think it's a fun read. I mean, as I said, anybody who can do Spiro Zelda and, in there, I was happy with that because I love anything with a Z. You see, I'm sort of partial to names with a Z. So anyway, it is... been a great pleasure to talk to you, Brian Deere, and the book is The Doctor Who Fooled the World, and I'm not fooling you when I say this is a great book. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Brian.
Thanks, Patsy. Lovely to talk to you.
Oh, talk to you soon, in a month.
Bye.
Okay? Okay. Bye-bye now. All right. Ooh, what a guy. What a book. Zelda and Scott out there, and there they were dancing on the beach. Can you imagine it? And this beautiful, beautiful, glorious weather. We're going to do a commercial, and then we're going to be back in a minute, and I've got a great author coming up.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back. And in a few minutes, I'm going to be talking to Vina Rao. Has she called in yet? No, okay. Big Ed is shaking his head. Thank you, Ed. Oh, I have to take a drink. This Clorox number 5 in the studio and everywhere I go. Oh, my goodness, where did I go? I went in some store. They were also spraying everything. Yes, we have to stay safe. Please wear your masks, people. I started wearing this fancy one that you wear, keep around your neck all the time so that I don't forget it, because I don't need any problems. Oh, please, I don't need somebody to stop me, start yelling at me or whatever. So I just, it's here until they tell us no, and then meanwhile we have to keep wearing it. I want to go back for a minute to the book I talked to about a few minutes ago, The Doctor Who Fooled the World. Sometimes you get these wonderful books that you know it's a nonfiction book, so I wasn't sure, and I saw that, you know, I love medical books anyway, but wow, it's incredible, because he is such a good writer, and that just shows what happens when you just have talent and you can put words together. And this was I was just so enthralled by the book. And if you, it's a thick book, so if you don't think that you can read the book, I would get the Audible. The Audible is wonderful. The narrator, an amazing voice, an absolutely amazing voice. And sometimes, you know, for some of you out there, if you're thinking of, you know, I have to, as many of you have sent me emails that you're starting to write, take a step back and, you know, find an Audible book that you listen to, and then as you're listening to it and the words come sort of flow through the book and you keep thinking, well, why does that have an effect on me? Why do those words put in that way really touch me? And then get the book. And then look and compare them. And you learn so much from that. One of the things that I've been talking to different people now who are in the process of writing, and I am really struck sometimes that they never stop to analyze the things that they've been reading. They read them, but if you want to be a writer, there are times where you just have to stop and take a step back and just read for the pure pleasure of reading one sentence or one paragraph. You don't have to read the entire book again, or sometimes you don't even have to read the entire book at first. Just take a section of a book and read it. And this is for all of you who are planning to write, and you want to write, and you want to get this sort of, you have a bug in you that you want to get this out. You want to get your words on paper. And, you know, if you don't take that moment in time where you've been reading something that you like, and then you stop and you go back and you know, mark the page. Don't you know, if it's your own book, if you want to mark the page, you mark the page. If you want to put a note in next to, and many authors have done that, and those books, oh boy, if you find a book that's been marked up by Ernest Hemingway, for example, one of his books, and he's put a note in there, you know, it's worth a lot of money. So don't worry about that, but just write it in pencil if you want. Or I even recommend if it's a paperback book and you're trying to learn how to write, take color markers and highlighters and highlight those sections that sort of speak to you. And I'm waiting for this author to call me. But in case she doesn't, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, This pandemic thing has gotten us all sort of crazy, but I'm just waiting for her. I know we were online earlier. But anyway, I want to talk about a particular book, because today this author's book, which is called Purple Lotus, reminded me of an author, Edna Ferber, who people don't read very much, but she wrote this fantastic book called So Big. So Big is an example of an author who paints a picture with her words. It's just so wonderful to read how she can take a simple thing like an auction for a picnic basket. So she's at, her scene is they're at a church social, and they're having an auction for a picnic basket. And here's how she describes it. One of the baskets that's coming up. A great hamper, grown so plethoric that it could be no longer wear its cover, its contents bellied into a mound smoothly covered with a fine white cloth, whose glistening surface proclaimed it damasked. A Himalaya among hampers. You knew that under that snowy crust lay gold, that was foul, done crisply, succulently. Emeralds in the form of gherkins. Rubies that melted into strawberry preserves. Cakes frosted like diamonds. To say nothing of such semi-precious jewels as potato, salad, cheese, sour cream to be spread on rye bread and butter. Coffee, cakes, crullers. It's just a... It's a paragraph about a hamper of food, a picnic basket. But she's done, in one paragraph, she has created an image that if you were going to stop for a moment on that page and say, I want to do a painting, you call in an artist and you say, paint me that page. I want to see that page forever and ever. I want it on my wall. I want to remember that hamper. Well, that's exactly what Edna Ferber did. And here, it's just so beautiful when you think about it. Think about what she did here. To describe the chicken, a snowy crust lay. The crust lay gold that was foul done crispy. Gold. So gold that. Who thinks of when you see a nice crispy chicken in Publix, you know, going around on the spit, and do you stop and say, gold? Oh, that's gold. Look at that! Look how beautiful that crust on the chicken is. Or when she describes a gherkin, one of those, you see those jars of beautiful, beautiful. I love it when the two for one pickles. Do you ever stop and think of emeralds? And do you think of rubies when you see strawberry preserves? Or do you think of cakes that the frosting looks like diamonds? And so many times now you go into the store and you see in the bakery they have cakes that are frosted and they have little sprinkles on them. But do you ever stop and say, I could describe that as looking like a diamond? And that's the difference. That's the difference between great writing and just ordinary writing. Somebody might say, that's a gherkin, a pickle. It's just a pickle. But if it looks like an emerald? Now start thinking how that is going to change your whole outlook. So I have a terrible feeling, Ed, that this lady is not calling in today. And I don't know if it was her time element, time zone. I don't know where she is. She's not. I thought she was in America, but she could be. She's Indian, and I don't know where she is. So I don't know how to get a hold of her. But what the heck? If she doesn't call in, I'll just talk. I'll just have to talk. Okay, Ed, is that all right? And maybe you can talk. What's new with you, Ed? You never say anything.
Oh, just working behind here, that's all.
Yeah, you're having fun always cleaning up between all the programs. How are your hands, okay?
My hands are very clean.
Very clean, okay. Well, see, Ed is very... a man of few words, but he is so good. And I get a lot of questions about it. They say, who is this guy who salutes you? So, and of course, he is here in the studio. He keeps everything going so beautifully. And as I said, I have no idea where or how or what I'm going to do with this author. I'm going to have her back because I want to talk to her about this book. What I like about her, and one of the reasons I wanted to have her on today, her name is Veena Rao, and her book came out on Tuesday, and I was already busy and booked on Tuesday. But one of the reasons I wanted to have her on is that she is a self-taught writer. She describes herself. She says, you know, she did not go to college to learn how to write. She doesn't have I like one of the things that she writes about herself in her little bio. She says, I'm a brown immigrant, female author with no MFA or Ivy League pedigree. And I taught myself to write fiction after I started working on my novel. If I could get a book deal, so can any aspiring writer. Now, aren't those wonderful words to live by for all of you out there? So many of you think, well, I haven't written anything. I haven't gone to college, let alone taking, you know, courses so I could get an MFA degree. But that's not important. It's not important. I know many people who have MFA degrees and... oh, what can I say? Their books are good. You know, you get an MFA degree and you learn how to put together a book and you learn how to you know, get everything right grammatically. But the question is, do you get everything right from the heart? Because if everything's been knocked out of you and in a way, if you've been told, like what Brian Deere just said in this interview a few minutes ago, the editor, when he wrote that it was like Zelda and Scott, and he did not put Scott Fitzgerald. He did not do it. He had the respect for the reader. He said, if somebody's reading this book, they're smart enough to know who they are. And if they aren't, if they don't know that, then if they're smart, they should be curious enough to look it up, because a name like Zelda and Scott, I mean, it's easy to look up. So it's a kind of respect that you have for the reading public. And that's wonderful. And when you're an author and you cannot put yourself down, you can't say, oh, I don't have this. Oh, I don't have an MFA degree. Oh, I don't have, I didn't go to college. You know, I barely made it through high school. I've been working, you know, for 30 years, and yes, I've learned how to do a little writing along the way. I've improved myself, but I couldn't write a book. But you can write a book, and you can start, and your first book won't be perfect. And many famous authors have told me that their first book was not perfect. But boy, oh boy, did they improve as they went along. And so this is what happens, you know, you get better, and you might keep your first book in the drawer for 10 years. You never know. But, you know, it just happens. And it's really exciting that the change that can come to you once you start writing and you have that joy on paper that I talk about all the time. And so I am very, very happy that Veena Rao is now on. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper to talk about your wonderful book, Purple Lotus.
I'm very excited to be here, Betsy. Thank you so much.
Wow. I was telling my listeners earlier as we were waiting for you that one of the reasons I wanted you on is because as you have described yourself that you have no MFA or Ivy League pedigree, but you taught
That's
yourself
right.
to write. And boy,
yes.
oh boy, did you do it. I mean, you are an amazing author.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I had to teach myself to write, you know. When I sat to write Purple Lotus, which was 10 years ago, all I had was a blank page, and the first things I typed was the title, Purple Lotus. And that's all I had to go on. So, you know, I had to actually teach myself to write. But I'm a journalist. I have a day job as a journalist. But, you know, writing newspaper reports is very different from creative writing. So I had to do a lot of reading first before I sat down to write. And even I had to polish my draft multiple times. And each time I think I got better. So it was a 10-year-long journey.
Well, it is an amazing journey and an amazing outcome because your writing is so beautiful, so poetic, and lyrical.
Oh, thank you so much.
There are just so many areas that I love, and I was looking at it again this morning, and simple things, and it was really just wonderful how you are able to take a simple idea, how an orange sun reached out, dousing uh-huh. everything he embraced in his glow. That is such a lovely line.
Thank you. It is. Well, I'm glad you like it. Yes, but, you know, it didn't come immediately. I had to write multiple drafts to get to that level and a lot of reading.
That's the way it should be, but you've kept yourself into this writing. It's so touching. And let's step back and you explain what this story is about, because I will tell people that the actual writing, there are so many phrases and so many sentences that when I was reading it, and one of them, I was talking to my listeners earlier about your book, and one that sort of stuck out was when you wrote, "The rice fields were waterlogged along the way, shimmering mm-hmm. emeralds." All of this is so beautiful. So tell us about the story idea, and then we'll talk about some of the actual writing.
Okay, so the story is about Tara, an immigrant woman from India who is in the American South, and she's trapped in a loveless, abusive marriage. So Tara comes from a patriarchal community, and she is under pressure from her family and her community to try harder to make her marriage work and to keep her husband happy and to just make peace with her circumstances. And then one day she discovers that self-love is a very powerful force. And it gives her the courage to walk out and follow her heart. But even then, she must still face her lifelong fears of abandonment and the sense of shame that is instilled so deep in her. So the overarching themes of my book are domestic violence, mental illness, abandonment fears, family honor, shame, and most importantly, the right to self-determination, which a lot of women around the world, you know, they don't have the same choices that some other women have.
Well, you know, we sort of, in America, we don't have arranged marriages like you,
right.
you know you
right.
you do in India, and
right.
And it's still prevalent in India.
Yes, but it may not you know, be as it used to be about 20 years ago, like back in the 80s or 90s. It was just, you know, parents arranging the marriage. Now, I think the prospective, the boy and the girl, they're allowed to meet a few times and make sure they know each other, understand each other. But these choices were not available, let's say, 20 years ago.
No.
Yes. I mean, you're right.
Yeah, you know, of course, we love Bollywood movies. My sister and I watch a lot of Bollywood movies. So we're sort of obsessed with them. She loves the ones where there's the music and dancing and the arranged marriages. And sometimes the arrangement doesn't work out and the bride runs off or the groom runs off and they find somebody else. Right. So those are romantic. And I love the more political Bollywood movies. I love the ones, Indian movies like Rajneeti, which is my favorite movie of all time. So, you know, we see that, and of course, before they might arrange a marriage for a very young girl with a older man, and it didn't matter if they ever met. So, explain, you know. Does this still happen here in America where they are arranging marriages?
Yes, absolutely. Marriages are still arranged all the time. But like I said, you know, if you don't want to be, if you don't like the guy your family proposes, you always have the choice to say no. But, you know, marriages are between families in India, not just the woman and the man. It's always between families. So families are involved. As you must know if you've watched Bollywood movies. Yes.
Well, you know, one of the things, of course, you mentioned that you love to read, and even as a child you were reading.
Uh-huh, yes. I grew up in a small coastal town called Mangalore in the south of India. And we had easy access to great books, American authors, English authors. So I fell in love with writing very early on in life. And when I was 12, I declared that I would grow up to be a famous author. And so I started writing detective novels with American detectives for my Indian classmates to read during lunch break. And it was my love of writing that got me into journalism. And then, of course, life happened. We moved to the U.S. in 2001. And a few years later, I launched my own newspaper. And I was consumed with the challenges of running it. And it wasn't until 10 years ago that I had the chance to get back to creative writing.
Well, you are an amazing author. This is really, as I said, Purple Lotus. Explain what a Purple Lotus is so people will know what it is.
Purple Lotus is such a beautiful, a lotus is such a beautiful symbol of rising above one's circumstances. A lotus, it grows in muddy waters, but it rises tall, beautiful, and pure toward the sun. And the purple lotus is a symbol of self-awakening. So, and it's traditionally considered rare. So I think, the purple lotus is the trajectory of my protagonist Tara's life. And now, of course, we have a lotus on the presidential ticket, Kamala. Kamala means lotus. And October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Purple, which purple is a symbol of domestic violence awareness. So I think my book is very timely.
It is. And you have some really fascinating advice for people during this pandemic. Do you want to tell us what... Well, you have four suggestions there. What are they?
I'm not sure, but I can tell you what. I go for long walks to de-stress. You know, it gets my serotonin level high. I meditate a lot. And just be positive. Fill your mind with positive thoughts, even if you don't actually feel positive. You know, just repeat a positive thoughts until your mind begins to accept it. And breathing exercises, I'm very big on breathing. You know, a breath can change your mood.
Well,
these are my four go-to advice.
Okay. Well, I want to tell everybody they should get your book. It's a wonderful book. It's called Purple Lotus. It's available wherever books are sold. And how do they find you? You have a website, and also
I do.
What is that?
Yes, it's Venus VEENAS Pulse PULSE .com.
And Venus Pulse. It's because you are. I think you are the only woman to have a Indian language newspaper.
I was the first.
And
I was the first.
Yeah, and
yes, it's called NRI Pulse. So that's been my identity for the past 14 years. So I Veena Rao was my first choice for website, but it wasn't available. So Veena's Pulse.
Yeah, well, considering the number of Indians in the world, the Veena Rao is actually a pretty common name.
It is,
you know, in India, and so I. But people can find you easily. Just type in Purple Lotus. It's a book that I think will touch your heart and open up some subjects of discussion about women's rights and women's and as you said about violence against women, and it is an important month, and the book is important, and it's also just a great read because you are a very talented author.
Thank you so much, Betsy.
Okay, it was great talking to you, Veena. Bye bye now.
Great talking to you. Bye bye.
Okay, beautiful cover on the book. It's wonderful. Anyway, so we finally got her, and I'm glad we did because you will, again, this is an example. She did it herself. She taught herself. And how did she do it? She did it through good, smart reading, checking out other authors, look at how they write, just do it, because I'm telling you, people, you can do it. There's a book in you. And I hope that most of you will, who are now working on it, will go to my website. You can send me a message, and I will be happy to, sort of steer you the right way if you need help. And because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture. You never know, and you won't know unless you try. And Kimberly Friedmutter wrote a book, and it's an amazing book. If you haven't read that one yet, she was here 2 weeks ago, and just check it out, Kimberly Friedmutter. You have to go to her website. Incredible woman. Unbelievable. It's a great website. And you can do it too. Just start writing. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed. As always, thank you, Ed, for everything. I appreciate it all. And everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And start writing. Bye-bye now.